a bandwagon critique. Today...
Welcome to Coffee with Creamer, where you get to sit down with our host, Dr. Barry Creamer, for a conversation about faith, life, and culture. We'll look at old ideas through a new lens, turn those culture wars on their head, and paint a picture of the way things could be. If you like your thinking deep and your coffee hot, pull up a chair. You're in the right place.
The prominence of populism in our political system right now is, has provoked some thoughts in me that want to find their way out into this episode, and so I'm going to be talking about populism. I actually entitled my document. I always have a working document of my notes on these things. Populism's problem. It's not a problem with this administration's form of populism. Populism has been pushing its way in toward the center of our political system and it does this repeatedly. It's in a cycle, I know, historically throughout the country's existence, it's been in a cycle. But I would say over the last not just 10 years, but probably over the last 25 years, as I've experienced it. And I've had a few conversations like this in different episodes, so I'm going to lean back on some of that information. But this is different. I want to talk about populism in general. And it does affect the current administration, but it also affects what would have been an alternative administration if someone else had won the election. Because it's not about this particular populist movement. It's about populism in general and what it means in a democracy and a problem that's always attendant with it. And populism is not the only thing that would have issues that are attendant with it. Elitism has the same kinds of problems. I'm just picking this one because populism has become such a prominent way of doing politics lately. And it's had an unusual wielding of influence over the last few years. So something to consider with it. So to set the stage for it, we need to consider the nature of our political existence. I've discussed this before. I think I can keep it really brief today with just a couple of examples. So there, and in fact, in order to make this point, I'll use two completely different ways of describing the same social reality. And that social reality is that the individual is always both the ally and enemy of society. It's just built into what it is to be an individual within a society. The individual is both the ally and enemy of society. And by the way, society is always both the ally and enemy of the individual. So I'm not trying to play games with it. This is just the reality of our political existence. If I were to put it in Freud's terms, which I've done before, and so again, I'm not going to just dwell on it forever, although I don't expect everyone to have listened to every single episode, and I certainly don't expect you to try to remember everything that I've talked about in the details. But if I speak about that ironic relationship between individuals and societies in Freud's language, then it's the issue of the ego and civilization, how they fit together and how individuals both love and despise civilization. Civilization and its discontents is the book that Freud has that deals most particularly and immediately with that subject, that question. Or you could get it out of The Future of an Illusion, his book Against Religion and For Science, you know. So again, I'm not a fan of Freud, but his intellectual influence is enormous, and the things that he discovers or describes are intellectually impactful as well. And this is one of them, that if we look at it from Freud's perspective, and I'm just super summarizing this, obviously, We need civilization in order to manage the larger parts of reality that we can't handle as individuals. And the perfect expression of that for Freud is just nature. Nature's too big for us to be able to manage. So we need people to work with us in order to overcome nature's threats. So we need, and Freud's going to use civilization as a substitute for society. That's how we're going to look at it, as civilization. It's from an era when that would have been used interchangeably in some ways. So we need civilization in order to manage nature's threats. This is a Freudian approach. And yet, at the same time, we despise civilization because the way it unifies us is by suppressing our individual tendencies. We get along better together when we're not killing each other or abusing each other. And the desire to kill each other or abuse each other or steal from each other, whatever it is obvious if you just watch toddlers when they're, you know, both wanting the same toy. But as we grow older and become more civilized, we learn that we should live within society's restraints because we value the society for the advantages it gives us in our desire to overcome the threats of nature and such. So the tendencies which would undermine our relationship with the other members of that society need to be suppressed by that society. And so the closest we get to resolution in that conflict, because our tendencies are something we like, you know, that's the stuff we want to do. That's why they're tendencies. That's what we want to do. And yet society's keeping us from doing it. So society is suppressing our individual tendencies. And yet we value that. So it's weird. You know, I value the thing that's keeping me from doing what I want to do. And the closest we ever get to resolving that, I'm just using Freudian terms, the closest we ever get to resolving that is in what he refers to as the superego, and you've heard of this before, where civilization's suppressions have become our own internalized repressions. So I keep myself from doing these things because I have a conscience. And what I mean by conscience is I have a way of thinking about the world that's finally been shaped by the society around me so strongly that I think of it as a part of myself. That's how Freud sees the resolution to it. But the conflict is the thing I want to point out. We both love and hate the things that society does to keep us in the society that we need while we wish we could get rid of it. You know, that's kind of how we exist with it. Let me put it in other language. If I speak about it from a Thomas Hobbes, who comes a couple of hundred years before Freud, at least a couple of hundred, then his language, and I'm speaking from the Leviathan in a quotation that I've provided for you before. Again, I won't spend much time on this, but his way of saying it is that, and I'll say the language first, and then I'll quote him, but that every individual ends up bequeathing authority to one sovereign for the benefit of us all. So here I want to have authority, but I need to give it away. But I give it away along with everybody else with a contract with that authority and with each other that we will submit to the authority's ability to exercise that authority, his sovereignty. We will submit to it on the premise that he's acting in the interest of all or of the society as a whole and not in his own interest, because that would just be one more powerful person taking advantage of the weaker person. That puts us right back where we were to begin with. The quotation from Hobbes from chapter 17 in the Leviathan is, "One person of whose acts a great multitude by mutual covenants one with another have made themselves every one the author, to the end he may use the strength and means of them all as he shall think expedient for their peace and common defense." The fancy language basically says all of the individuals come together to grant authority to one sovereign, and it doesn't matter whether that's an individual or a parliament or however you put it together, but it's in the voice of one government, basically it comes down to, the sovereign being the nation, for the benefit of all. Obviously, in a kingdom, he's thinking of a king being able to do that, but acting in the interest of everyone else. Why would we give up the authority to that one person? Because the one person represents the entirety of society, and we need society because nature is bigger than us. And all of, in fact, there are individuals within that society who are bigger than us. And we need society to follow this contractual arrangement we have in order to both have it because we want it and yet restrain it, us and the individuals that are in it and the society as a whole, because we still want to be able to do the things we care about as individuals. That tension is present in every society all of the time. It's the nature of existing in a society. And the tension is that we depend on society to protect us from selfish individuals who might be more powerful than us, from natural forces which might overwhelm us, from the whims of groups, especially mobs and their behavior. We need society as a whole to protect us from those things that are bigger than us as individuals. But we would, if we had a choice, we would act contrary to society's restraints if we could just get away with it. I've spoken before in many episodes, several episodes, about Plato's Ring of Gyges, the idea that's carried forward into Tolkien, you know, with the Lord of the Rings and the invisibility that comes when you put the ring on, the Ring of Gyges, you turn it around on your finger and it makes you invisible. And then Plato gives that as an illustration to make the point that if you really were able to be made invisible by this ring, you would certainly do it to take advantage of those cases where you wanted to resolve something a certain way, but you couldn't get away with it if people knew you were the one who was doing it. And so you get away with it, you would do it. That's how all of us are. Now, I don't mean we would literally go and do it, because some of us would just have the self-restraint not to go do it. But that self-restraint, again, is part of our acquiescence with a society that's causing us to have to use restraint not to do the stuff we want to do. You see what I'm saying? The tension's just built into it. You can hear it my voice, can't you? Anyway, here's the thing. All of those things come together to say that what we want and what we don't want are one and the same thing. Very often, they are identical things. For example, we both want and don't want the people who annoy and bless us. How are you going to get around that? We want the people who refine the gas for our cars. We don't want the people who demand money from us for us to have access to that gasoline. They're the same people. We don't have a choice. You despise and desire exactly the same thing. We want the self-control that inhibits us and fulfills us. And we don't want the self-control that inhibits us, but it fulfills us. So we do and don't want exactly the same thing. It's not a surprise that we do and don't want exactly the same thing in society. I'm not saying this because I think, oh, you know, some people are just not paying attention to the way society works today. I think a lot of us are not paying attention to the way society actually works today. But my point is, it works this way for everyone. And on occasion, when we get a certain amount of control within a society for one group or the other, it doesn't matter, we act as if, finally, I'm going to have the society I want, the one that's perfect for me. But it's always going to be a society that both is and isn't what you want. We need it, and we need to decide what those controls are going to be like, and they're not all morally equivalent. It's good that we take a stand and want to enact legislation that brings about better things and so on. I'm in favor of all of that, but it doesn't change that we need to be circumspect about how we're evaluating our relationship with that society. And so, if we have an understanding of why we come together in political alliances and how we talk about those alliances, then it can help us with this discussion about what's going on right now in our culture, in our society, with populism. And really, it's going on around the world right now. Not a big surprise. Again, it comes in cycles. So it would come either way. And sometimes it comes in cycles that are moving to the left. Sometimes it comes in cycles that are moving to the right. The populist movements aren't just one way or the other. They do go both directions, as we'll talk about in a little bit. So the nature of political alliances to keep in mind, again, not brand new vocabulary to us if you've been listening to these episodes for a long time, to this podcast for a long time. There is a difference between these terms that we use for different elements of society that would be worth mentioning. Society, as one of them, is just, you know, all the people who share a social space. It doesn't even mean you necessarily choose it. You just de facto, you're on the road together. You go to the same grocery store. You live in the same neighborhood. You cross paths when you're hunting the same wild game. You know, you're a society just because you're interacting with each other. You share a space. But a community, much stronger than that, again, we've talked about this before, is you know, it's the portion of a society within which you find your identity and with which you share an interest. You have something in common. Your neighborhood can be a community. Your church could be a community. A group that you're involved with at school or in something else could be a community for you. You know what I'm saying? So society is a broader thing, community a more specific thing. In both of those contexts, you have the possibility of a government, meaning an individual or organization, some kind of apparatus with authority to impose order on that society, to establish policies or whatever that are going to govern what we're going to do as a society or maybe a community as well. Then, and we talked about the difference with this one substantially for a long time in an episode a good while back, but the state, which is different than the government, which is the administrative apparatus, the administrative instruments by which a society preserves its stability. This is why it's referred to as a state. And the way we do it, we think in the United States, we think of government and state as being practically synonymous, but they shouldn't be. We should understand that differently. Day for a different episode. Maybe you can go back and listen to the episode where we talked about that distinction if you get an opportunity to do it. Daisy will link to it on the website. Anyway, there's the state. And then there are, in our country, we refer to them specifically as political parties. So there are political alliances or political bodies. And, a political alliance or a political party in our particular culture, it's a community of shared interests. It is something where you find your identity. I'm a Democrat. I'm a Republican. I'm a Libertarian, whatever you want to be. But those political interests, those political parties, I should say, those shared interests, they are the kinds of interests that we come together, that this is what makes it political instead of just some other community. It's political because these shared interests will require, we believe, the tolerance of or compatibility with or maybe even the benefit of society as a whole. So we want to shape the rest of society around our agreement on these issues. So this is now a political body that we're a part of. So it's a community essentially seeking to use government for its interests. So you're pursuing some kind of governmental influence. And you can hear that in the way Republicans would meet together and say, here's our platform. These are the things we agree about. And now we're going to go and try to shape society by winning elections and changing the culture. And Democrats who would do exactly the same thing with different issues for different reasons. But they're really the same reason. We're seeking to use the government for the interest of the political body that we're a part of. All right. So how does that fit into populism? Well, populism is, as I understand it, and all of these are just my definitions. They're not ignorant definitions, as I've studied these things over a long period of time. But they're my definition, and they're the working definitions that we're going to have for today. A political body's reliance on, mass appeal, this is populism, a political body's reliance on mass appeal, and I mean by mass appeal to majority interests, in order to achieve that governmental control. That's what I mean by populism. And you can see that in a populist politician standing in front of the crowd and throwing red meat out in the messages that he's presenting or she's presenting in order to get the crowd drummed up, because you know where the mass of sentiment is in that audience and you want to use it to propel yourself, your party, your movement into the fore of governmental influence, right? Then one way or another. So that issue is what leads to a conundrum for our society when we tend toward populism. And again, I think what we mean to happen with the populist movement is for the majority to get their way. And they're the majority. And in our particular culture, we're a democracy. So you would think the majority, they should have the influence that they ought to have. And that's precisely where I think we run into a little conundrum with populism that we may not pay attention to. It doesn't condemn the left or the right, because every populist does this on the left or the right. And it doesn't really condemn them for wanting to exercise governmental control. That's what every political group wants to do. And every movement within a political group wants to do that. Populists just might not always be aware, those who, especially who are leading populist movements, should be, but may not be aware of this, whatever, tension, conundrum, however you want to say it. And so there are a couple of steps we need to take in order to get there. So, you know, government's authority is, and this is just built into the, you know, what a government is because of what we were talking about in society and how we have a relationship with it. Government's authority is an individual's protection from the whims of larger social forces. And, you know, it's built into that is the reality that if you have a constitutional approach to law, and if you think of the Supreme Court of the United States, SCOTUS, interpreting the Constitution to determine whether something even can be a law or not for us, whether it can stand as a law or not for us. So a constitutional, we have a written document that is the supreme law of the land. If we're going to have a constitutional government, a constitutional approach to law or government very deliberately protects minorities and individuals from, you know, one expression of it is the famous quotation, the tyranny of the majority. This is the point of having the rule of law, that you don't just get run over by the mob or run over by society, but we have instead established this stable, written, constitutional declaration of who we are and why we are that, that protects individuals to be able to continue to exist in that society, even when an angry crowd might not be pleased with what they're doing in the moment. And that's the key here, that it's not necessarily stable in its forms. So populism tends, by its nature, to see government as an enforcement mechanism for that very majority. That is, and how else would you see it? You know, if you're a populist, that's what you're thinking. Well, we want to appeal. I mean, otherwise you're saying, well, populism is just an appeal to the base population, you know, to the ignorant and the, and I don't think that's what it is. I don't agree with that. I understand why people would say that at times, because everybody's being included and it's not as elitist and they're not being about a meritocracy anymore. I just don't think that's what's going on with populism. I think very often populists are looking at themselves, and I mean in the population, not necessarily among the political leaders. We could pause there and have a discussion about political leaders and how pure their motives are or aren't in any given situation, but that would be an entire episode, right, or series of episodes. Maybe we should do that before long. That would be worthwhile, not just for one party or the other, but for both, because there are plenty of issues. See, I want to do a whole episode on it. Gotta stop. Okay, so the point is that it, within the populist movement, I mean in the population itself, I think there is a tendency to see it as a way of saying the majority of people need to retake control of our governing bodies. This is sort of a revolution of the majority. This is what all the people want, and we're the ones who are expressing it. So we're going to fight back against those elitists who have, with their small numbers, been dictating policy to those of us who've been in the majority. I can understand the frustration of people who would feel that way and would say, let's take it back. Let's give it back to the people, so to speak. That's how populism tends to see its nature. So populism, by its nature, as best I understand it, would see government as an enforcement mechanism for the majority. But here's the thing. The majority may or may not be paying attention to the details of the Constitution intended to circumscribe the boundaries within which this society is supposed to function. That, and I'm not saying that insultingly. All of us pick out the parts of the Constitution that are most interesting to us to protect our own interests. That's the nature of us being individuals within a society. But I find that populist movements can do exactly the same thing, pick out the parts that serve their interest the most, not necessarily the whole of this purportedly stabilizing document of a constitution. And so where that takes us, interestingly,
in my perspective, it's interesting. Seems interesting to me. We'll see what you think. And I think this is the main point I want to get to. Where it takes us is to where the two-party system is for our culture, for our society, because we have a two-party system. You can vote libertarian. You can vote consumer, but you're not going to win. It's just not going to happen. Maybe you'll get one representative in Congress. Oh, look at that. We have a Congress that's no longer bipartisan. It's no longer just two parties. That's just not true. We're Republican or Democrat. Maybe that will change. I don't know if that will change in the future. The realignment that's going on with politics right now, if anything could shake out the two-party system into something new and different, this would be it, in my view. Do I think it's going to happen? Nah. But I'm not being a prophet about it. I'm just, you know, historically, I've seen a lot of times when we thought it might and never even got close. You know, we have a two-party system for a reason. And I think that's related in some ways to some of the stuff that's going on with populism right now. Not that one causes the other. I don't mean that. That's not my implication here. But that there is an inescapable and observable relationship between the fact that populist movements can become what they do and the way the two-party system works in our culture. Let me explain what I mean. There are other options than a two-party system. I'm no expert in this, but from my decades of existence in the world and paying attention to other societies, it's obvious there are other than two-party systems. Obviously, you know, there are autocratic one-party systems, even if they pretend to be two-party systems, which we can find in plenty of places right now. We can look toward the rule in Russia right now. Not very difficult to realize no one's going to win an election there. But whoever is in charge of the party right now, that's just the way it's going to be. So there are one-party systems. I'm not talking about that. There are also other political, you know, other societies with multiple political parties that have a different way of organizing their government than just either the Republicans or the Democrats winning control from one government to the next. And that is to have political parties. So I haven't described the way our political parties put together their interests yet, but you can tell it's a coalition of interests that are built together into a single party. So the Republicans are the conservatives and the Democrats are the liberals or the progressives or whatever you want to say. But that represents this whole list of issues with which some people within that party even agree and others that people within that party disagree with. So that's the two-party system. You end up with these amalgamations that can't be parted from each other. All the Republicans have to be together. All the Democrats have to be together. But in other systems, there is this way of political parties having very specific shared interests instead of necessarily a conglomeration of shared interests. So you could have a party that is the Labor Party, and it just represents the interest of the laboring population, the blue-collar population, or something like that, the union population we would think of in our culture, or a Freedom Party, which would, by the way, be parallel to how we describe in our culture over the last 20 years, the Freedom Caucus, as it's been talked about within congressional circles, or the Tea Party movement. But notice they don't call it the Tea Party. They do call it a party, but they don't call it the Tea Party, and then form a political party. This is the Tea Party, and if you want to run, we'll have a primary. And they were always a part of the Republican Party. There were probably people who wanted to do the other, but they couldn't do it because in a two-party system, you couldn't do it. There are other societies where that would be a party. That would just be a party unto itself, or the Environmental Party, or a Communist Party, or a Socialist Party, or a Democrat Party, or a People's Party, or the Christian Party, or the Christian Democratic Socialist Party. You see what I'm saying? So all of those are options. And then the way the governments are formed, you create a government in after an election or in a parliamentary session, but you create a government by cobbling together a coalition of those parties to be able to win a majority of seats if you're in a parliamentary system or something like that in a representative type of government. And then you can govern. Oh, okay, so we have this guy who's going to work with both the Environmental Party and the Labor Party to put together a majority of interest so that now we can form some government policy. That's one way governments form with political parties trying to shape society around or in defense of their interests. That's one way it happens. The other way it happens is our way, a two-party system. And each party is in itself a coalition of those interests, representing what they believe to be a potentially whole society. Not just, let's shape government policy so that it serves laborers better. Not that. It is, let's reshape the whole of society so that it serves our party's interests, which cover the whole gamut of our political interests. It covers the whole gamut of our lifestyle, for instance, or whatever it is, that want to shape the whole society in favor of their joint interests. Each party represents that, what they believe to be a potentially whole society, which would be tolerant of or compatible with or even benefit their joint interests. And so there are some particular challenges that are created by that model. We're familiar with the challenges that come from that model because of the primary system. The primary system can put the majority within a party, so the majority of Republicans or the majority of Democrats, in a contrasting place to an actual plurality, having more people who are opposed to them within the society as a whole. It's a very interesting conundrum for our society that has to do with the two-party system. All of us have heard this described and seen it lived out in the way the primaries function with our parties, and then the candidates go to the election, and then you end up with a candidate where people in the middle are going, I don't like that guy, and I don't like that guy. What am I supposed to do with this? And the reason that happens is more than just the pragmatics of a primary. I just want you to think about the numbers for a second, not because the numbers are magic. They're super simple. I believe they're simple. And so I want to throw them at you. Just hang with me for a second in this. I'm only going to give about four different numbers. So don't panic on me because I mention a number, right? Some of you, those of you who are engineers and mathematicians, you're like, please, this is the only moment I even want to listen to. I understand that, but tolerate the fact that most of our audience, they're not the kind who are trying to take math courses all the time. I'm a humanities guy. You know, they're listening to somebody they didn't think was going to bring up percentages here. So let me just give you an example of what I'm talking about here. So if you take in our society, the contrasting parties, and you just take and say they each have 50%. Listen, we're going to oversimplify in order to make the point statistically or numerically, just numerically. So we have a 50-50 model. 50% in our society are Democrat, 50% are Republican. I know that's not true, but let's just pretend it's true for a minute. Then let's say 60% of the Republican Party represents 30% of the entire society within that picture that I'm describing, right? That's an easy number to work with. So here's the problem. That means that a 40% minority within that party, because 60% is what we're describing as being able to win the primary in this case, let's say. So it's 60% represented this particular viewpoint. We're going to rule in this way. Let's say in the last election cycle, 60% of Republicans were Tea Party type Republicans, right? And let's say in the last election cycle, 60% of Democrats were Bernie Sanders Democrats, the sort of AOC socialist kind of Democrats. And I'm using stereotypical language, right? I'm not picking a side. I'm trying to say on both sides. Let's say 60% of the party could determine who was going to win the primary. Let's say that was the case. That leaves 40% as a minority within each of those parties that was overruled by the majority within their party. But think about this. The two majorities within their parties, first of all, they don't agree with each other. That's not a single block. They're opposite of each other. They're never going to agree with each other. The radical right Republicans are never going to agree with the radical left Republicans, unless it's about something like reopening the government. That happens every once in a while. But that's not what I mean. I mean shaping the whole of society here. They don't agree with each other, right? This is the way it is. So the two majorities within their parties, representing only 30% of society each, and they're not a single block, those are 30% one way and 30% the other way, they leave 40% of society in disagreement with either majority. 40% opposed to whoever's winning those primary elections, right? In the middle, the people are stuck there. And we've heard that description before, but we usually think of it as the small middle, the part of the middle that really can't decide whether they want to go left or right. I mean the whole middle, that middle 40%. So what we can't, and this is not mythical, I'm going to give you a hard example in just a moment. And by hard, I mean a literal and practical and actual example in the real world. So what we can easily end up with is a 30% minority within society because one party or the other wins the final election, right? And they win it with the support of some of the people in the middle who actually disagreed with them but agreed more than they did with somebody else, right? So what we can easily end up with is a 30% minority within society exercising the powers of government to exert control over up to 70% of that society and against that 70%'s will. Those numbers, this is the actual example I want to get, those numbers are not that far removed from what polls are indicating right now about higher education. And I choose higher education because I'm in higher education. And I hear the discussions and I know what's going on with it. And it's fairly fascinating. There is, and I'm going to deal with it from the conservative populist movement right now, but I would do exactly the same thing from the left, from the progressive side, were they in authority, about other issues. Issues having to do with health care or health mandates or government mandates about this or that, whatever. I could do it with them too, and I think we would find exactly the same kinds of numbers. But these are hard numbers that came out just recently in the Chronicle of Higher Education. So there is an anti-higher ed sentiment within a lot of the conservative populist movement right now. Not within all conservative movements, not within all Republicans, but within the conservative populist movement right now, there certainly is an anti-higher ed movement. And I'm not even without understanding of why that is. I think there are some rational concerns that are expressed in that movement. Tuition is out of control. And the kinds of constraints that they'd like to see, I think they find completely reasonable. You know, let's just give a fair footing to all the different ideas that want to be expressed on a campus. Progressives and conservatives would like to agree on those things. We just don't necessarily agree on what a fair footing would be. And so we have some real challenges about it right now. So, you know, I would make the same point about the progressive populist push, the Bernie Sanders, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez side of the Democratic Party. But in that case, it would be about the antagonism that's present there toward free market economics in that populism. The populism of those who don't like anything about capitalism or whatever it is. And again, not mocking it because I understand there are some real critiques to be had there. I just think it can run amok. Anyway, here's the point. In this recent Quinnipiac University poll, which was reported in the Chronicle of Higher Education, I just read about it this morning as I'm recording it a couple of weeks ago, probably as you're listening to this. What the poll was about was the current administration's contract with higher education, this offer for, you know, universities to compromise some things, to give up some things in order for the administration to get some of the things it's interested in seeing in higher education. So what the administration does in a typical characterization of this contract with higher education is to use federal funding as leverage, especially toward, you know, this funding toward research and such. As leverage to enforce universities' cooperation on issues like diversity, equity, and inclusion, or closing down programs that are seen as too adverse to conservative perspectives, or whatever. And I'm not exaggerating. I mean, that's a minimal description of some of the intrusive nature of this contract. And again, intrusive because people think there are abuses on the other side. That's what the populist movement would say about higher ed right now. Not without any justification at all. There is some justification there. So anyway, the point is, this poll, overall, 57% of respondents opposed increasing the federal government's role in how colleges and universities operate. And according to the poll, 42% strongly opposed doing so. They're adamantly against this disruption, and only 25%, that's even below the 30% threshold I was talking about earlier as the sort of example that I was giving, just one quarter, 25% of those polled supported more federal oversight of higher education. And only 12% supported it strongly. So you can hear how, in reality, this movement, this current movement, has taken a form in one particular area, and it's the area that's close to me, obviously, higher education that I care about, has taken a form that really the majority are indicating, at least in this poll, which is just one poll and may not be exactly right, but it's interesting how those numbers reflect the fact that it is easy when populism takes control of the political process to the extent that the government's exertion of its legitimately coercive powers ends up taking a form that a vast majority of Americans in this case actually don't favor. And yet it's a populist movement somehow. That's, you see what I'm saying? This is a kind of odd conundrum that you have a populist movement that's saying, let's let the majority have control again. But what's actually happening is a majority, which turns out to be a minority, sometimes exerts those controls in a way that a majority of people precisely don't want. So while populism seems like a reversion to majority rule, even when it's being denigrated as a tyranny of the majority, it can easily find itself as control, sometimes beneficent controls, sometimes malevolent controls. That's not the point. But it can find itself as control being exercised over a majority by the minority. It's an interesting way to kind of lose our path sometimes. Populism can, ironically, and again, this is on both sides that it can happen on. We should be cautious about this happening at any time. I've talked about mobs and how odd we are as human beings when we behave in mobs. And you would think that leaders, politicians who ought to be leaders, social leaders, preferably social servants, would have a sense of the moral responsibility to do better than feed a mob and instead, those things that inform and guide and lead, because it's not a mob in the nature of the individuals who are just trying to see a better society. That's not a mob. It's not a mob until it's drummed up by someone, until it's driven into this corner by someone and threatened or shown a threat. It's not a mob for an individual to say, I feel like my opinions are being neglected. That's not a mob. That's not the end, but that, just an individual saying, no one is listening to what's happening to me. No one is hearing how my concerns are being overlooked. When that gets turned into a mob, that's not that individual's fault. That they are a part of the population, but they're a part of the population that should be heard. We should recognize that whenever we're exerting, and I, again, had this whole conversation in prior episodes, so I won't spend much time on it, that whenever we're serving the interests of one part of society, we are inevitably pushing back against the interests of another part. Not economically. I'm not talking about that. I believe in an expanding economy and everybody benefits, or, you know, rising tide floats all boats kind of idea. I'm all for that. But in reality, we should be listening to the voices who are saying, you're ignoring me. So I don't mean by this that a populist movement is populated by individuals who are inherently part of a mob. They're a mindless crowd. That's not the problem. The problem is how leaders are relating to that and using it to shape the political landscape as if they're only acting in the interest of the majority without paying attention to what turns out to actually be a majority. So populism can ironically become a form of paternalism with that level of, I don't know what the word is to even use, but it's political leadership, but it could be as negative as manipulation, right? So it's just populism, it's a shame, and it's a reality, though, always, historically, it's always been this way, that populism, ironically, can become a form of paternalism, whether it's benevolent or not, or just downright elitism. Like, I know what's best for you, and I'll take care of you. And don't get me wrong, elitism has its own problems. I don't want to pursue that either. But we're always going to be pursuing one or the other. It's just that I'm talking about the one that actually is motivating political forces most strongly right now. The point is not to disparage the majority of people, but to recognize that populism is not actually very likely, not often, and I don't know that it ever has, represented a majority of the people who will be affected by its power. And, you know, therefore, I'm trying to give us cause to considering carefully just how much control we want exerted by government in either party's hands. And I know what you're thinking. If you listen often, I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, you sneaky little twerp. You took us all the way down this discussion just to get us back to an argument for smaller government. Would that really be such a bad thing, by the way? Admittedly, I'm always in defense of a small government, and I don't just mean so industry can get away with whatever it wants to do or so that you don't have to, you know, support welfare. I don't mean that. I just mean government, you know, it's a Thomas Jefferson line, that government is best which governs least. It's not a statement that there's nothing for government to do or that there aren't very significant issues for government to address. You have to have government doing its job for a society to be able to maintain its order. I'm for that. My point is that what we do over time, whether populist or elitist, is this ratcheting movement of giving government more and more leeway to do whatever it wants to do, because when we're ratcheting it up and giving government leeway to do whatever it wants to do, it brings us advantages. It opens the door for us to have more freedom to accomplish the things we want to accomplish. The problem is that we're not always the ones who are in control of that government. And that will come back at the point when someone else who now at the wheels of this much larger government is able to do the very things that we had tried to preclude happening to us in the past. So I'll admit that there is sort of this motive of saying, yeah, you know, let's remember smaller government can be advantageous, meaning no one has the power just to do whatever they want to do, but they have restraints, restrictions on them all of the time. That is sort of my point. That's one of the things I want to get across. But really, it's just about seeing, again, that whatever advantages we gain for our side, whoever you are, whoever you consider our and we there, whatever advantages we gain for our side are the same disadvantages we will experience when the other side uses those same advantages for their control, which is why what we seek ought to be more like this. Not populist control, not elitist or paternalistic control, but instead constitutional controls and the stability that follows with them for as many of us, that's we and they, us, all of us, as possible. As odd as it sounds, the greatest risk in populism is that it serves only one very vocal and active part of the population as a whole. It may be my part of the population, maybe yours right now, but it's still only one very vocal and active part of the population, and that can be a different part next time. When what we need, and I think what most of us desire, is a government which, to the best of its capabilities, it's ironic to talk about government capabilities when it's shut down right now, but I don't know, maybe it's opened up by the time you're hearing this. Maybe. Anyway, what we need, and I think what most of us desire, is a government which, to the best of its abilities, capabilities, serves everyone in the population. That's the point, not just the loudest or most forceful. And that becomes not a populist movement because it doesn't follow the inclinations of those who are speaking the most loudly and forcefully. And again, I'm not against the loud and forceful speaking. Sometimes you need to be heard and you need to shout in order to be heard, but only serving, you know, only greasing the squeaky wheel, right? That's not the way to run anything. And certainly not the way we want a government run. And I don't know many people who do want it run that way. We need one that's serving the whole population. So if we value freedom, and practically everyone I know does, even the people who disagree with me politically the most, they still love freedom. If we value freedom, then we have to value it for everyone, even the ones who are not in control of the government we already believe ought to be limited anyway. So using the opening analogy, I'll close with this line. I guess I'd simply say that if you do find a bandwagon nearby, you may want to think long and hard before you jump on it or off of it.
as the case may be for you.
Thanks for joining us for Coffee with Creamer. Your cup of coffee may be finished, but we are not. Come back next week for a refill as we sit down to examine a new set of ideas and cultural issues. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or visit our website at barrycreamer.com. Until next time, keep your mug hot and your mind sharp.